I don't think that Unitarian Universalists are the only faith community who have a penchant for claiming that people belong to them, especially if they're people that we like or respect or who have some measure of fame. I'm not sure how many of you who are here this morning who remember a guy named Steve Allen. If you've never heard of him, he was a writer. He had a wicked sense of humor. He was the host of several of the early late-night TV programs. And occasionally, he would drop into a nearby UU congregation. Of course, the powers that be were delighted to claim that Mr. Allen was a convert to our faith community. I'm surprised his photo is not out there in the foyer, but I had Susan check, and it's not there. He was concerned enough about how this might all appear to producers and advertisers that he wrote a press release stating that no matter what anybody else said about him, he was no such thing. At one time, he said, he had joined a Unitarian Universalist congregation, and for reasons that he did not wish to discuss, he had decided to move along, and he no longer wished to be identified as a Unitarian Universalist. At the time, people who took an active life in the role of the association were very disappointed. They liked the idea that somebody in pop culture with the amount of influence that Steve Allen had decided that we were on the right path. I think today if Khloe Kardashian said she was a Unitarian Universalist, maybe Jimmy Fallon, can you picture it? Jimmy Fallon making little comments about why he had decided that UU was the faith community of the future. The Kardashian clan making their way down the pathway to one of our congregations, hidden behind the leaves as a sign of our commitment to justice, environmental, and otherwise. And all of this is an introduction to a very, very free-spirited person whose name was Walt Whitman. He lived in the 19th century, not in the 20th, and he might well have joined us if he ever joined anything, which he never did. Truth is, he was never in one place long enough to sign up for anything. He liked to ramble, and he claimed the life of the road as his own. There aren't many people nowadays who wander the way Walt Whitman did, but he covered this country, which wasn't even a nation then. He covered this nation from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Canadian to the Mexican border, or where those borders were going to be eventually. And when he finally began to write and publish his poetry, the country that we call the United States had just come through a war that divided family, that split brother from brother, friends from friends, neighbor from neighbor. About half the population of this country, this one that we are all part of, really believed that they had the right to buy and sell human beings, to take children from the arms of their parents and sell them for profit, to starve them and make them work in the most brutal conditions until they dropped. The other half of the population thought these practices violated the will of God and should be done away with. Bear in mind that the documents that we treasure, including the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, decreed that any person who came here from Africa was worth 3/5, 60% of what anyone who came here from Europe was worth. And state populations were actually predicated on that belief. The number of representatives that you got in the House of Representatives was based on that premise, that white people were worth 100%, but people of color were worth 60% of whatever that total is. And people fought and died to defend these beliefs. Ministers preached that God's will either depended on believing that and practicing it or opposing it. Walt Whitman in the 19th century was a guy who hung out with people who opposed slavery, like Waldo Emerson. They both wrote about their experiences through which they determined the nature of reality. They did not turn to books and texts. They did not listen to philosophers or go back even to Aristotle to figure out what the truth was. Walt Whitman believed that the truth was what he could touch, what he could smell, what he could hear, what he could see, what he could feel. And that principle is called transcendentalism. It's a principle that is alive and well in our community because I am one. I'm a transcendentalist too, and I believe that that's where reality comes from. It comes from the things around us, And right now, today, we are around each other. So we're creating a community of reality here in this room. And Walt Whitman would have agreed with that belief. Some transcendentalists believed in the existence of God, and Walt Whitman was not one of them. He opposed slavery to the point of working in the filth and the stench of field hospitals, where soldiers wounded in the Civil War were treated. And last night I couldn't sleep much, so I read when I'm up late at night. And last night I read a book called The Hour of Land by a woman named Terry Tempest Williams. She was writing about the national parks in brilliant language, and one of the national parks she chose to write about was Gettysburg. She brought the reality of Gettysburg home to me in a way that no other writer has ever done. And she pointed out that Walt Whitman, so you have to remember that the Battle of Gettysburg involved more men armed, wearing a pair of shoes and the clothes they stood up in, armed with a bayonet with 40 bullets if they were lucky, and that's all, a spoon if they had anything to eat. Those were the people who fought the Civil War, and when the Battle of Gettysburg was over, their numbers were beyond our ability to comprehend. And when it was all over, and they were trying to deal with the people who had survived and what to do with the people who had not, Washington Mall, which we look at now as a place to celebrate the 4th of July, Washington Mall was covered with them. You couldn't see grass for men. They lay everywhere. They lay on cots. They lay in the grass. Sometimes they had water. Sometimes they didn't. But their numbers stretched as far as the eye could see. And that's where Walt Whitman went to look for his brother. His brother had fought in the Battle of Fredericksburg. His brother's name was George. And he fought in the Battle of Gettysburg, and Walt Whitman found him. He found him. Among all those men, he found his brother. He bandaged his wounds. He cared for him, and he recovered. George Whitman went on to live a very full life. Walt Whitman, however, looked at all those men who had no one to be with them, no one to care for them, no one to care about who they had left behind, and he stayed there. He stayed on Washington Mall for 3 years, and he either bandaged them or fed them, gave them water, found resources for them when no one else could. And when they were dying and no one else was going to let their families know, he wrote letters for them. He found something to write with and something to write on, and he took their words down and the addresses of the people that they had left behind. And he wrote a book called The Wound Dresser. He wrote, "I am faithful. I do not give out. The fractured thigh, the knee, the wound in the abdomen, these and more I dress with impassive hand, yet deep in my breast a fire, a burning flame." He described the soldiers who fought in that war, the most brutal war that Americans have ever fought in, which we are still fighting today. The ideas behind the Civil War have not gone away. We are still talking about whether it is the war for the Southern economy or the war of Northern aggression. We are still talking about the same issues. And Walt Whitman, who spent those years on Washington Mall caring for the men who fought that war, wrote, "Swiftly and arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own. And I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own." So I'm describing somebody that you might think of as kind of a hero. He is certainly a hero of mine. But at the time he was alive, he was much more complicated than that. He loved everybody. And when I say he loved everybody, he loved everybody. Today we would describe him as either gay or bisexual, depending on which, you know, politically correct language he wanted to use. But in the 19th century, there was no vocabulary for love like that. Oscar Wilde in England called it the love that dare not speak its name. Ministers called it either sodomy or sin. He wandered the highways and the byways once he had finished nursing those men on the Washington Mall. And as he went there, he loved women, he loved men. All of them, he thought, had been created in the image of God. if he believed in God, which he didn't. They were all his brothers and his sisters. His partners in intimate relationships were almost certainly men, women, and anybody else. And they were described by one reviewer as including that horrible sin that cannot be mentioned among Christians. His belief in the health benefits of nude bathing and sunbathing simply gave more grist for the newspapers that thought he was absolutely dreadful. He was a terrible person and certainly no one that we could look up to. And if some publisher was foolish enough to publish these poems that he wrote, they had no meter. They didn't rhyme. They didn't look like the kind of poetry that most people now, even today, if you were reading Victorian poetry, you would not look for something like what Walt Whitman wrote. When he was wandering around writing these poems without meter and without rhyme, he'd look for Quaker meeting houses because after his experiences in the Civil War, what he wanted more than anything else was peace. He believed absolutely with the Quakers that we must work for peace, fight for peace, establish peace among all of us. And occasionally he would find a Universalist church because the Universalists in that time were mostly similar, very, very similar to people who went to Quaker meeting houses. That's where he found the people who believed as he did. He filled journal after journal with his poetry. Forget the rhyming, forget the meter, he thought. He didn't have any formal rhyme scheme. He didn't learn any of that, you know, trochaic, this, that, or the other, or pentameic, whatever. He wrote about the experiences that he had in the world. Earlier this month, in this pulpit, a man named Thomas Rain Crow told us and reminded us about the importance of beauty in our lives. And Walt Whitman, with all he experienced, did the same thing. He believed that we must look for beauty everywhere, all around us, inside of us. Beauty, not rationality, was the fundamental principle of his work. In the Song of the Open Road, he wrote, "All seems beautiful to me. I can repeat over to men and women, you have done such good to me that I would do the same to you. Wherever you are, come travel with me." His sister in that kind of poetry was Emily Dickinson. So if you love Emily Dickinson, she's sort of Walt Whitman's cousin. And today, if you like this kind of poetry, you would probably read Mary Oliver, who's another person whose poetry I admire. He wrote so openly about the human body, which we're all sitting in right here, right now, with all of its travails and aches and pains and beauty too, that he wrote poetry that celebrated sexuality rather than saying that it was something that couldn't be talked about, so that when he finally did publish Leaves of Grass, which he had to self-publish, he couldn't find a publisher who would take it on, and it was described when it came out as obscene. Well, he didn't care what it was called, and he continued to work on those poems and revise them and republish them until his death in 1892. What is it about a man like this that makes Unitarian Universalists want to claim him as one of our own, even though he never signed the membership book? I've already mentioned his work in the Civil War. At the time, Victorian morality, which was practiced by such notables as, here's a name you're going to recognize, John Harvey Kellogg. You might have eaten some of his products for breakfast this morning. Well, John Harvey Kellogg had a reason why you should be eating cornflakes for breakfast. He actually seriously believed, and so did a lot of American society, that that was the way to keep children from touching themselves and doing things that they were not supposed to do, because cornflakes would take those ideas right out of their minds. Well, he might have eaten cornflakes, but not for that reason. There were transcendentalists who used their own experiences to create a pathway to God. Others, like Walt Whitman, believed that these experiences were enough in themselves. They didn't have to go anywhere. They didn't have to create a pathway to anyone or anything. These people renounced the idea that these pathways had to go somewhere, and they remained in the here and now. Another book by Aldous Huxley that was a real turning point in my life. was here and now, boys, here and now. And I read that and have never forgotten it. He used practices like meditation and writing to keep their minds from wandering. And the poetry and the writings of the transcendentalists provided the basis for what we mean by here and now. And what I mean is here, who's here now, and what we're talking about and what we're thinking about as we are together. When I was born, the world was in the midst of a war that had engulfed Europe and Asia and Africa. A philosophy called fascism demonstrated what can happen when the practitioners of one particular religion were determined to eliminate, completely eliminate, the practitioners of another religion. And it's 70 years later, and you know what? Here it is again. We are still meeting the same practices, the same beliefs that the practitioners of one religion should have the freedom and the privilege to eliminate the practitioners of another. And I can assure you that Walt Whitman would have been somebody that they wanted to eliminate. But the works of people like Aldous Huxley gave me a framework with which I could begin to understand why in the world people want to behave like this. So when I discovered that there was a faith community that included philosophies like transcendentalism, I was thrilled. I felt accepted. And I still believe our tent had better be big enough to include people who read the Bible and love it and revere it, and the transcendentalists as well. Because if we don't have room for both of those, I would say right offhand about half the people in this room had better find someplace else to meet. And I don't want to do that. I want to meet here and now with you, all of you, whatever your beliefs are. I've told you a little bit about what attracted me to Unitarian Universalism, and I want to tell you very specifically what made me write a sermon about Walt Whitman anyway. Ron Parton called me up and asked if I had anything that I wanted to speak about, and I had just finished going through the web pages that the Unitarian Universalist Association has created. They're pretty interesting, but there are also a lot of them, so if you get started and go from one link to another, you'll be there for a while. And in particular, because I am a religious educator, I love religious education. It's the lens by which I came here. And I know a lot of people who have practiced religious education. One of them was the Reverend Frank Robertson, who was a minister of religious education in Evanston, which is a suburb of Chicago, in the early 1990s. And as I got to know Frank better, I also got to know how much he revered Walt Whitman. He was a prod. He used to ask me if I was reading Whitman and what I was reading, and he cared about what Whitman had written and what he had done. So the fact that I thought Frank was fabulous meant that I thought Walt Whitman was too. So in addition to reading together, Frank and I also participated, and Susan did too, in a group that was called Interweave. I don't even know whether Interweave still exists. I think that it does. But in those days, you have to realize there was not one openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person who worked for the association, and that meant that there were no ministers, none. There were no religious educators like that. There weren't supposed to be any ministers or religious educators like that. But Interweave had a different message. Interweave said, "We're all here, whether you want to acknowledge it or not. We all read Walt Whitman together." And at a time when there were no openly gay or lesbian people that we could turn to, Frank and I used to go to Convocation, which was the big annual meeting that Interweave held, because it was where we could be who we were. It was where we, one time in San Diego, held an Interweave Convocation where the adolescent children of our congregation said, "We don't want y'all to do the cooking. You just relax, go to your workshops, and have a good time. We'll cook for you. We'll wash your dishes and care for you." I couldn't believe that either. I couldn't believe that we were doing such a good job with our kids, the job we're still doing nowadays with programs like Our Whole Lives, that we could teach those children that it's okay. We love who you are. Whoever it is that you discover yourself to be is just the right thing, not something that you have to change or worry about. No, we're going to celebrate it with programs like Welcoming Congregation. So Frank and I, and Susan, with the people who were then our partners, and now, because the marriage equality question has been answered for now in this country, maybe not forever, but for now, so most of us now are married with people with whom we've been for 50 or 60 years, and finally are newlyweds, because we can actually wear wedding rings and get married just like everybody else. So when Ron asked me what I wanted to speak about, and I was reading these pages that the UUA had put up, I found one called the Walt Whitman Fund. Well, I didn't know there was a Walt Whitman Fund. I was amazed. And they said some things that I want to tell you about it, because it turned out that what Frank had done was to decide that he wanted to find a good way to use his money. Frank and his partner had been together for decades, but Frank died long before marriage equality became a reality. So he had a fair amount of money, and he wanted to put it in a good place. And he established something called a charitable remainder trust. And I know that there are people in this congregation, Barbara Eck is one of them, and Skip Sheldon is another, who could help you learn what a charitable remainder trust is if you want to put some of your money someplace where it will do some real good through a group like the Community Foundation or this congregation or the association. And what Frank did was to use his money through the UUA with this charitable remainder trust so that when he died, the money went to establish the Walt Whitman Fund. And the mission of this fund is to increase public awareness of UU values and perspectives on social justice issues, particularly as they affect gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning persons. And another part is going to help the UUA's Beacon Press strengthen its offerings on these issues, and that will be named the Walt Whitman Series. I can't wait to read those books. Frank chose the fund's name to honor the poet who was the very first person in American literature to celebrate the affection between men and to develop a language for homosexuality. And there were other people that contributed to his fund. It isn't something that you have to do all by yourself. You can do it with your friends and your neighbors if you want to. And that's what Frank did. The road that he traveled is still here. It's right here in this room. It's in this community. And it's the path that I travel myself. Because I am a transcendentalist, and I believe that whatever has happened in the last week that has absolutely broken my heart, still, we are good. We, as human beings, no matter what we do to one another, are still fundamentally good. I believe with the person who gave the Ware lecture this year, whose name is Krista Tippett, that we really can all become wise as we explore the mystery and the art of living in this world. And for me, this is the world we have. It's the only one we have for me. So I think that Walt Whitman would like the fact that we're all sitting here this morning talking about what John Kellogg thought cornflakes were going to do for children. And reading poetry that doesn't have any meter and doesn't have any rhyme. A lesbian woman who is American, whose name is Chris Williamson, wrote a song that I'm going to sing for you to end my remarks this morning before we close our service together. And it goes like this. And here's where you should probably turn the mic down because I'm going to sing again. Open mine eyes that I may see visions of hope thou hast for me. Open mine eyes, illumine me, Spirit divine. That's the spirit that I hope we in this congregation will take out into the larger community, celebrate as we get together every week in this room. That spirit is the one that Walt Whitman used and the one I hope we use too.